Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What special Woo Reality. That's for February 7th, 2026. And we're going to be covering Chapter 8. My name's Nancy Hopkins, and our job here is to give you, write an audio book with podcasts and then put it into text. So what kind of a backwards way of writing, but I've been doing a lot of radio. It's very comfortable for me. And this is the way I decided to do it. So we're at 8. And 7 ended with my enlightenment to a few things. The first, that ETs were walking among us and some of them were working for the U.S. government. The second, the deep state was far deeper and darker than I ever imagined. The electronic battlefield was worldwide and included psionic weapons designed to work as direct energy weapons that could kill with energy at great distances. But there was another thing I learned that was the scariest of all. Vincent Collins, the ET who looked human, had one last image to send me telepathically at our last meeting. It's an image I watched materialize in my world. The third thing I had learned was the world's population was to be controlled by building a worldwide grid using electromagnetic energy we now call the telecommunications network. So, because we were having a necessity to deep dive into nowhere, become nothing that would garner any concern in the world, let's put it that way, I was guided to this Parker Plaza condominium in Hallandale, Florida. That I was there for 25 years, and mostly the time was spent, well, it was from midnight to 8 in the morning, and it was mostly spent, you know, with 5 hours or more being able to research on all the subjects we've already covered. So Parker Plaza was a perfect job. I got to do all that research and was being paid for it. But it also offered, let's say, opportunity. Opportunity to, first off, financially support me to a degree that was kind of interesting. Prior to that, I had done a lot of I was a handyman. I'd go around and, you know, do things for people, for, you know, make my money. I was a waitress. I mean, I played a lot of jobs until I got the Parker Plaza job. But it was an ideal job, except for the fact that it didn't pay anywhere near what I needed. But I was guided to take the job. And somehow, even though I didn't seem to make enough money to support myself, I always paid my bills. I'm not exactly sure how all that happened, except a couple of times. Because inevitably, if you own a house, you're going to have some kind of a thing that happens that you have to put out a lot of money, like a roof, that type of thing. And I would get into these semi-crisis situations where it's like, oh God, where am I going to get that money? And twice, I was gifted A bale of hay, except the hay was marijuana, twice. And in the first case, it was about $10,000 because it had been an open package and was not in, it was wet. But I still made money to cover whatever big project was needing covered. And the other one was a completely sealed bale that made me $20,000. And I just, every night I had to go out and walk around this acre that was the pool area. And there was a concrete fencing, but it wasn't just a wall. They made some designs in it and stuff. It was very attractive. And not, I mean, 200, 300 feet off of the bat position on the pool deck was the ocean. It was a very small segment of beach, actually. The condominium was built too far out into the ocean. Other condominiums never got a permit to do that. So anyway, I would go out and I had this big industrial flashlight. And I'd go and I'd check all the plants. No, none of the sprinklers are leaking. Everything looks fine and the pool is fine. There's no crisis there. And, just all around, just checking things out. And then I'd go down to the beach and I just sort of like stand there and take it all in. There's nothing like seeing the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean at night, where the sky is lit up because you don't have any of the city lights, right? I mean, you do behind you, sort of. So it's not as bright as it could be, but it's pretty damn bright. Of all these stars, just, oh, it's so magical. And twice I was just looking, putting the flashlight up and down the beach, just checking, make sure everything's okay on the beach. And twice I found marijuana that paid my bills. So I was being financially assisted in this amazing 25-year job that gave me the time to do this research. So one night I'm out there and I start from the area farthest away from the ocean wall. But as I walked out the door, I noticed something beyond the wall in the ocean. And I glanced at it and then I glanced away and I'm talking to myself and I'm going like, that looks like a UFO on the ocean. Yeah, sure does. And then not doing anything, didn't think about it. I mean, I was aware of it, but I didn't really put any thought into it. I just was really looking and focusing on the flowers. Are they doing good? Yeah, I mean, it was like it was taking me forever to get to that wall at the ocean, but I was gonna do my rounds just like I always did. And when I got there and I'm looking out, I'm going like, this, there is a UFO, I don't know, 600 feet from me. On the ocean. And all of a sudden, it was like I could see inside of it. It wasn't so much like I was inside of it. It was like I could see inside of it. And there was these three yeah, it was three people inside the vehicle, but that I saw. But I was really focused on this one who was a female, long blonde hair, absolutely gorgeous, I think, because I can't really, I wouldn't be able to tell you what she looked like, except the energy off of her. And I can't tell you about her eyes or any of that because it was like I was telepathically communicating with her. It wasn't like that's exactly what was happening. And so I'm having this conversation, and I was aware that as I'm having this conversation with her, my brain is getting filled with information. It was like they had got a downlink in my brain, and all of a sudden I knew there were there was this other energy field that was carrying information that was going into my brain. And then I sort of like came out of this complete trance, but a real trance. It wasn't, I mean, it was happening in this trance, but I was like locked into it. And I sort of come out of it and I go like, oh God, what am I seeing here? Is this real? And I look down. When I thought about that, I'm looking down. And then when I look back up, it was there. I wasn't looking inside anymore. It was there, but there was a distraction to my right on the beach that took me, and I started looking at this couple that was walking down the beach. And they were having a good time. It's like 1:30 in the morning, and they're having a good time, talking back and forth and laughing and just walking. And all of a sudden, the girl looks up and she sort of had a little start, like, what's that? And she whispers something to him or says something. So I couldn't hear, it was too far away. But she says something to him, and he looks up and he's looking directly at what I know is the UFO. And then he leans over to her and he says, well, and he said, he must have said, it's a boat. What's the problem? Because she just looked at it again and then went, oh, and then they just kept walking and they didn't really look at it. They were very engrossed in themselves. And I just keep my eyes on them, and they're walking down the beach, and they get so that they're kind of like, now I'm seeing them, but I'm also seeing the UFO. And don't you know, I'm looking at a boat. I can see a boat. The lights that were going around the middle of this disc are now up in the sails and rigging and whatever, but it was the outline of a boat. The deck had lights on it. It was a boat. And I'm going like, oh my God, what kind of a, what the heck is all this about? But the couple kept walking. And as they walked by the boat, all of a sudden the lights changed and the boat disappeared and the UFO was back. And at that point, I was like, I was laughing because to me, it was like complete confirmation that what I was seeing, I was seeing. And the fact that that couple showed up at that time, I mean, the whole thing was, I was getting used to feeling like a lot of the things that happen around us are being manipulated by thought that other people, Black Confederate, I don't know, but it's like maybe it's our own self teaching ourselves is what I mostly feel. But anyway, something gives you all these indicators, because if you listen to all the stories I've told you, every one of them had some other person who could witness it. Or something came up that proved that it was true. All of the stuff I'm telling you wasn't just I'm saying it, it's my imagination, and nobody's going to listen to me, because there were people there that shared the experience with me. But I just was experiencing a lot of things, So then they told me, we've got to leave now, but you've got to go back into the condominium. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to see you leave. And they said, no, you can't do that. And then she said, we want you to go back in there and read the book that you just bought. Well, I didn't know how they'd know I just bought this book. I mean, I just bought it. I hadn't even opened it up. And they said, so we need you to go in there, but and we want you to know that you will not see us for a very long time. Okay. All the way in, I cried. I felt like I was leaving my family. I never turned around. I went into the office. I opened up that book. And that book, I can't tell you what the title was. I only know it was a green cover. But I knew that whatever I learned in that very esoteric book was something that really was important to my thinking from then on. We'll get into what I think that is maybe later, but it was a profound experience, the book itself, never mind what led up to it. It was crazy. And that was, basically the only woo-woo thing that happened in all those nights at Parker Plaza. A couple of other things, but nothing to talk about. But what was happening at the Wilder Yard during these same years, the 1990s? I'm telling you, the 1990s were just magical. And I used to have a co-host on this show, Christia Cummings Slack, remembered the 90s just the same way I did. It was pretty amazing. When she passed over, I felt like I had lost somebody that was could confirm that what we were that we were the timeline that we were on was much different than the timeline that you and me find today. And she had gone through the same timeline shift. I'm going to tell you a story about that in just a second, but I want to kind of go back to the Wilder Yard in the 90s, which Christia was, she confirmed everything I said about the 90s. The 90s were magical, absolutely magical. I was not into current events. I hadn't thought about JFK in years. I was into metaphysics, into energy healing, into mineral energies, and all the potential energy devices that we have. So the other thing about it was that if you thought about something, it would almost always manifest in some way or another. The instantaneous manifestation capability was really, really nice. It made things move so smoothly. It was just a wonderful time to be alive. At the Wilder Yard, and of course, we had Crystal. Now, Crystal is the woman who owned a mineral shop. And she's the one that told me about Ben, that he had had this jammer put into him, and that whole story, then the cat. Well, Crystal went on and began to really work with the healing capabilities. And she got it down to the point that one day I went to the vet's for an appointment. I had a dog with me. And the person who was the front desk person became a good friend of mine. And she said late last night or late yesterday afternoon, somebody had brought in a kitten that was, there's nothing they could do for it, the poor thing. I'm not going to tell you what had happened, but it was, they didn't think it would live through the night. So they took care of it overnight and stuff, but they don't stay there all night long. They get everything set up and then they leave and they go home and they come back the next day. So, but she told me that they had this poor kitten there. So when I got home, I called Crystal and I said, I know you said, you're trying to work with animals. Here's a great, this is what's happening at the vet's office, and told her the address. And I said, go for it. They've given up on this kitten. If you can heal it, well, then you're going to know. And so the next day, I get a call from my friend that's on the desk. Oh my God, when we came in this morning, the cat's absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with it. So that type of thing was happening. All right. And we had classes, like we just, there were certain people that clicked together and we had classes here. And it was just a lot of fun. At the same time, I was bringing, doing all those energy device, making the energy devices, and I was also collecting minerals. And we came across this wonderful little store. They would get these huge rocks in, and then they would cut them into different specimens, pieces. But we could often get there when they had one that they hadn't even cut, and they would sell them to us. So I would spend money I didn't have, but somehow always did, for these expensive, big pieces of rock. And then I'd get home and I'd get the voices in my head. I had to take these pieces, specimens that you'd see in museums in some cases, and take it to a place they're pointing to on the in the yard and leave it. I haven't seen them. I don't look for them, but I haven't actually seen them in years. So, and there was at least three or four, I know there was three. And I think there was another fourth one that was not quite as big, but they also started up a whole bunch of other stuff that I'm going to get to in a minute. But back to Crystal in the store. She apparently decided to, I wasn't buying from her at that time. I bought everything I needed from her, and she wasn't quite as active in getting classes there. Something was happening, and I just wasn't being drawn back there. So I didn't know she was thinking about actually quitting selling the business until she called me and said that she had this woman who was interested in buying the shop and needed a place to bunk for a couple of days while she, looks over the project and so. And so that's how Brenda Brock came into my life. Brenda is a very interesting person because she was one of the first people to ever get involved in telephone psychics. And she was down here and she was going to buy Whispers Crystal Shop. And at the same time, set up one of these phone networks. And at that time, before cell phones, you had to go to a place that they had phones, and that they were. It's all very local. It wasn't going over the internet and all. It was very local, so you had to go to this networking place. And she was running that, but she's considering getting the store. And she comes, I had room, I had a guest room that I could put her up in. And she comes out, I think it was not the night that she, the first night, I think it was the second night that we got to talking about different minerals and things. And she said, "I want to show you something." And she goes back into the guest room. And comes out and she puts this square black rock in front of me that's about an inch and a half long, probably 3/4 of an inch thick, and about an inch and a half wide. And she puts it down in front of me. And all of a sudden I get like, I've got to get up and I've got to get, I'm not thinking, I'm just kind of following the directions again. I got to get up and I got to get this ruby, this beautiful, unbelievable ruby that's almost as big as that dimensions of that rock. So I get that, and then I get other things that I've got to get. And as I'm starting to move, I said to Brenda, "You better open up because something's happening and you're probably getting messaging." And so she kind of like, because remember, she's setting up psychic telephone things. She knows what she's doing. And she goes, oh, you're right. And so then she goes off and she gets some stuff. And she comes back in, and there was one other rock that I put on top of these three. So there was three of them. And as soon as I did that, I was like, this was was like I was out of body. I mean, it was like very strange. And I'm flying all over South America. I saw the Jesus Christ in the on the mountain in whatever country, South Bolivia, Colombia, I don't know where. And I can't, I'm not going to get into all the details because honestly, I don't know that I even remembered them at the time. But I finally came back and I'm like, oh my God, what just happened? I mean, it was like a whole half of the globe that I saw in this, I didn't even know how long this had happened. And she came back at the same time and she was like, oh my God, yeah, what the heck just happened? And she had gone to the other half of the world. And we had done this amazing, just been taken all over the world, etherically or out of body. I don't even, can't even tell you what was happening. And we got the sensation, or I got the sensation, that we had just realigned the earth. It was like we were these magical wands that went all over this half of the world and realigned it at the ley lines. And ley lines are very, very important. The energy field of earth is where the magic is stored, essentially. And once I began to work with the Wilder Yard, I began to understand that concept about ley lines. But this was, something that I was already thinking about and working with. But it was Brenda who, amazingly enough, went on the same trip with me. And then I'm sitting there and she's sitting there, and all of a sudden I go, we're not done. I said, they want us to, this is not over. And she had to go back and her, what few things she had. And I had to go around the house getting all these weird things, incense included, and sage, and I mean, not just a lot of crystals and things. And I walk out into the front yard and I look up into the sky and I'm pretty stunned because without a doubt, there were a dozen, maybe a little less, maybe nine lights that absolutely were brilliant. Like if you took the it wasn't anywhere near like a full moon or anything. It was like if you took the moon and compressed it so that it's a small ball, but it's bright. It could be a planet if it wasn't so big and bright. And so I'm looking at these things and I kind of like tune in with them, and I go, yeah, this is ET. I don't know who these people are. And I just started, I continued doing the things they wanted me to do, which was making a grid. I had to make a grid. At one point, I called Sandy because Sandy was very much into to this sort of thing. And I said, I don't know what's happening here, but why don't you come over and get any messaging? You might be told to bring some stuff. So she comes over and she walks up to me and she said, so what's happening? And I said, look at the sky. And she looks at the sky and she went, oh my God. I said, that's what's happening. And so she starts getting the messaging and we're making this grid in the front yard. And All of a sudden, Brenda starts poking at me, hitting me in the arm. Nancy, Nancy, look over there, look over there. ET, over there, over there. And I'm going, why is she so freaked out? She supposedly talks to ETs. It's part of her, what people know her for. Why is she so freaked out? And, so I look up and I see, yeah, okay, it's like, one of the mid-sized grays. And but I'm on a mission to make this grid out here, and so I'm doing the grid and stuff. And I said to her, she said, but Nancy, she keeps poking me, and I said, Brenda, look at the sky. And she looks up and she went, oh my God. It was so funny. But anyway, so that was an interesting thing. I'm not. I never did. None of us ever talked about it, what happened. Not, it just, they had us do this thing. So I don't know. I don't really know what happened. So Brenda was there with me for a few days. And the story behind this black rock was really interesting because a friend, she was up in Atlanta, and a friend of hers came over and said, Brenda, I got this rock, the black rock. I'm afraid of it. And she tells the story that a friend of hers had been in Mexico at the big pyramid and had seen this rock, this square, this black thing on the ground, picked it up, put it in his pocket, and you're not supposed to take anything back with you in this area. But he did. And I don't remember if she even knew, but something happened that spooked him about the rock, and he gave it to her because she was into minerals and crystals. And she was living, I think, in Chicago at the time, but she was on her way down to Atlanta. So she takes the rock and she puts it in with a box full of crystals, good crystals, and leaves and comes to Atlanta. And when she got to Atlanta, she opens up this box and everything in it was shattered, just absolutely shattered. It was full of chips and stuff of the rocks. The rocks were shattered. And the only thing sitting there was that black rock. And so she was freaked out and she gives it to Brenda, and Brenda's on her way to Miami. And that's how that black rock got to the Wilder Yard. That ended that woo-woo event. But Brenda was there with me. And this one day I come home and she's sleeping. I get the voices, go out to the backyard. Okay, so I go out to the backyard and they're telling me, go here, go here. It's a big backyard and it's all overgrown. And I come across these scaffolding, the stuff that they put around a building when they're doing repairs and stuff, scaffolding. And it's in a pile that I had actually never seen. And because it was so overgrown. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with it? And I get the word build. So I go back in the house because the voice has stopped. I go back in the house and I'm sitting there drinking some coffee, trying to figure out what is this about? And Brenda comes out and she goes and gets a cup of coffee and lights up a cigarette. And I said to her, there's some scaffolding out in the yard. I want to show it to you because I've got a message to build something with it. I don't know what it is. Can you tell me at least where to build it? So she goes out there with me. I show her the scaffolding and then I stand there and wait. And she's got a pendulum. And she's walking around in one direction, this direction, and then she finally goes over to this one place that's towards the far east and the far north corner of the acre. And she said, "This is it." And then she went back in the house. That's all she said to me. "This is it." And then she goes back in the house. So I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, but I'd fed the cats and the dog, and I go back out there and I start taking the scaffolding one piece at a time over to where she said they were supposed to go. And I'd put them together, and I had some way of tying them off. I think it was just duct taped at that first stage. I think that's what it was. Tying them off together to make this shape. And I'm just taking the pieces as they are and putting them together. And in the end, it was this really interesting shape. The scaffolding themselves stood about 4 feet high. And one side was like three of these lengths, and the length was at least 10. So it's 30 feet in long. And then one of these things, a 10 footer, and then another one, a 10 footer, they had connecting these two sides together. And I grew in this by myself, and I never, every piece worked together. It was so weird. So I do that, and it's taken me, not as much time as I would have thought it would have if I had planned it out. But the sun's getting up there, and I said, "Well, I don't even know what this is supposed to be, but okay." And I go into the house, and I take a nap. I would nap during the day. So I take a nap, and when I get up, I reach for a book that I had been re reading, and it's called The Keys of Enoch. There was a page holder in the book where I'd finished off reading, and I hadn't gotten very far into this book at all. So I go where I had finished reading and turned the page. And when I did, I'm looking at a diagram of exactly what I had just built. Now, the one in the book has got a few more other things added to it, but the basic structure of it, that's what that scaffolding had created. Now, that's definitely a woo-woo event, But it didn't stop there. Now, Brenda went on and did buy the store, and I never actually went over there once she bought it. I don't know why, but I didn't. So anyway, Brenda's out of the story right now. But then the Merkaba, well, the thing that they were showing in the book was called a Merkaba. So I started calling this structure the Merkaba. After I did got that frame up, the messaging started coming in. And this is days later. This didn't happen all at once. It was, all of a sudden I'd come home and I'd like, "What are we doing today? Oh my gosh, what are we doing?" And what they did was they had me get this copper wire. And I'm t talking about there were two cases of it, and I know they were at least 20 feet of this copper wire. So a total of, and it's thick wire. It's you wouldn't have it that thick if it's not like wall the you find in the wall. It's a little less than that, but it's thicker than a lamp, line wire. So it's not that thick, but they had me go over to this area inside the Merkabah. And to flatten out the dirt, then to take all of this wire and do this intricate pattern on the ground. And then They have me go get these blocks of glass. Give you an idea of the manifestation. I wanted to take this, make a hall, take part of a room to make a hall. And I wanted to put in glass blocks. So I priced them, and they were expensive. I didn't have that kind of money. A couple days later, I'm coming home from Park Plaza condominium, and on the side of the road is a huge wall, what had been a wall and taken down, of these blocks. I filled up my van. I couldn't put all of them in it because I was really afraid that the axle would break. There was that many of them. I get home. I was only half a block away from my house. I get home, I build the wall, and I had these extra blocks, and they make me go get these blocks, and then I had to cover the wire with these blocks. So I make this thing, which is, if you lay down on that, it is unbelievable energy. It's just, unbelievable energy. But now that's been added to the Merkabah. Then, and Peter was involved in this. Then they had me take copper piping. And the piping was about a half an inch thick, and they were 10 feet long. And to build a pyramid on top of the Merkabah scaffolding. So you got the scaffolding in that elongated shape with the two points at the end. And they want me to build, and it's 4 feet high, and they want me to build the equivalent of almost a 6 foot high pyramid. So I do. I get Peter to work with me. We put the thing together outside of the Merkabah. And he's somebody that actually does all sorts of handyman work. He's a professional at it, And so we put this thing together, so it's sitting on the ground, and it's got the four sides, and then even on the base is all connected too, so it's all one piece. Well, luckily Curtis comes by, and we get him to help us because we got to take this thing and put, I think it must have been, yeah, it was like 6 feet long copper legs that we put this on because we wanted it to be over the Merkabah, to encompass the Merkabah, but we needed this extra, these legs. So the three of us were able to get it over the Merkabah and to put the legs in. And as I was putting the leg in, now they had, they weren't three of us, and we had one that was, we kind of jammed the leg up underneath it. But there was the three of us, and we're all putting the legs in. When I pushed mine in, it went down about 3 feet, and then all of a sudden it slid out of my hand. There was a cavity under there. That was some kind of an entrance to the underground. And maybe I'll get into that story, but that was another woo-woo aspect of putting this pyramid up. That was strange. I actually had to move the leg slightly. We had to take everything out and move it slightly to be able to miss that cavern. So anyway, so now with Merkabah's got a four-sided 6 foot tall pyramid on top of it. And it's got the wired in grid system underneath it. Not right underneath the apex. It was off to the top of the Merkaba. So Curtis comes into the picture, and Curtis is a master with copper. He was making all sorts of copper geometry forms. I mean, it was really, really copper art out of pipes, half inch pipes, that type of thing. And he comes over, and he's got this device that he's put together. And he said, I've got a second one that I made, and I'm going to go to Bimini. Now, Bimini is off the coast of Florida, 30 miles maybe. I don't think it's much more than that. I don't really know, but it's close to Florida. It's a small island. And he was going to go to Bimini, and he was going to bury this, the twin of what he's got in my yard, in Bimini. And he actually did. But he hadn't done it yet, but that's what his intention was. And he wants to bury the one he's got in the Merkabah. So we open a hole in the Merkabah directly under the apex of this pyramid, and we put this device in it, and then we cover it up. And all of a sudden, I get this yelling in my head, run, run, run. And I started screaming at him, run, run, run. And he was like startled and what? And I just turned him around and pushed him, run. And so we run outside the Merkaba, and we're probably 60 feet away when I realized that one of my cats was inside the Merkaba sleeping. And I didn't know why I had to get out of there, but I said, oh my God, the cat's there. So I turned around, and I think I must have said something or something because he stopped too. And we both turned in the same direction, towards the east, towards the Merkaba. But as we turned, there was this huge, and I'm talking about, it had to have been at least 4 feet tall and was an absolutely huge beam of white light, came from the south, went right by us by about, well, I'd say probably the angle it was probably 80 feet, right by us and into the Merkaba. And it got under the apex, and it like split in two, and some of it went up and some of it went down, and it disappeared. I mean, it was like stunning. But the most interesting part about it was, this happens, we see it happen, and all of a sudden, I'm looking at the Merkaba still trying to say, did that really happen? When the cat ran out of the Merkaba, I mean, this was a fast cat, and she was running faster than I've ever seen a cat run. And she got about 6 feet away, and she jumped into my arms, and thankfully I could grab her. And she turned right around in my arms to look back at the Merkaba. Well, that's another testimony that something definitely happened, and it came from a cat. I could get into so many different stories about what happened in the Merkaba. We started having people, they were like drawn to the yard. We would have these get-togethers of music and drumming, and we had all sorts of drums and rattles and stuff and chant tambourines and all this sort of thing. And so we would get together, and there was only one professional musician, but all of us seemed to be able to put music together. And we get together. Sometimes there was 20 people there. Sometimes there was, a half a dozen, I mean, eight, nine people. I mean, it went, and there was many of these little get-togethers. And at one time, We got together because Shoemaker-Levy was a comet that was about to hit Jupiter. So we decided that it would be really interesting to experience that energy effect in the Merkabah. And we go to the Merkabah and we're all sitting around and we were aware of the time and when it was supposed to hit. And somebody said, "Oh, it should be hitting pretty soon here." So we all got real quiet and meditative and stuff. And as I remember, it took like 40 minutes before we ever felt anything. But you could not deny that you were not feeling something. And the entire visual reality had shifted. It was a purple hue. It was weird. And somebody said, "Is anybody seeing purple?" And somebody else said, "It's the same thing I see when I'm on LSD." But that was the only communication at the time. It was a very, very powerful energy that came in. So, I mean, we were having these types of experiences there. I mean, I could get into a whole slew of them, and maybe I'll decide to do that. But inside the Merkabah, we were actually affecting ley lines, all sorts of things. I mean, well, one of them was really interesting. It was only three of us, myself and that partner of mine, and his wife. And we're sitting there. It was a sunny day afternoon. We're sitting in the Merkabah. And she and I were talking. He was basically just sitting there. And she and I were talking. And then all of a sudden, I found myself someplace else. But we did this together. She also had the same thing happen to her. All of a sudden, she's still looking at me and stuff, but we're not in Merkabah anymore. We were inside a, had to have been 3 or 4 story rock formation, like a tower. And there was a window there. And I think there was a couple of them. So it was like a tower that you could look out over this landscape. And she's saying to me, "I'm not going to do this again. I want to get out of here." And I'm trying to convince her not to leave. But she's, "No, I'm going to leave." And the only other thing other than that information was that when I was looking at her, but to her right, I could look out this window and I was seeing what I would have thought of as Aztec or Mayan structures. And then it didn't happen for very long before, boom, we're back in the Merkabah. And she looked at me and she said, "Did that just happen?" And I said, "Yeah." And we looked at him and he went, "What happened?" He didn't get caught up in this thing. So over the years, you sort of pick up, let's say, the story behind the event. And that was a very interesting event in that we were from, I don't even know if we were from the future or we were from outer space. But we had gone many times to this earth plane, trying to awaken them to the realities of cosmic reality. And every time it happened, the same thing happened. The people would see us as gods. And then you can't free people and waken them if they think you're a god. It just won't happen. And we'd been trying and trying. And she was over it. She wanted to leave and go home, wherever home was. But I said, "I can't leave." And two other people decided to stay with me. And let me just put it this way. It's a very interesting journey that the three of us took. I assume they just left, but we went up to the Arizona and the Keiko Canyon area. I do believe that this is Cocopelli. They had somebody that was up there named Cocopelli. I believe that's who it was. And we get up there, and it was a different society than we had been experiencing. I don't remember a lot of the details of it, but it was massive. And I found out later that that was actually a very, very busy trade center. You knew about the caves that were carved out and stuff, but there was a lot of other structures, including a huge road that archaeologists have discovered with the ability of, aerial and laser photography and stuff. So it was, Keiko Canyon is much bigger than people think of it as. And there was a Native American Indian, one of the people that lived in Keiko Canyon, who taught Cocopelli secrets that Cocopelli didn't know. And he realized that there was something about hu human beings that was more special than anybody in his ET family or wherever they came from knew about. And that the human being was special. She taught him all sorts of wonderful, from healing, using energy, manipulation of energy, and stuff that they didn't really, it hadn't, the woo-woo reality. They hadn't accessed it. They knew about technology and all sorts of things, but they didn't know about this. And she taught him that. Now, there's a interesting thing about this because the Aztecs are known for doing sacrifices, and that they would cut the heart out, beating heart of somebody in their sacrificing. Well, in reality, they copied that from these people, Cocopelli people. And what would happen is from time to time, one of their gods would fall to injury or sickness because they weren't gods. And one of their teammates there, if the person was about to die, they would actually cut out their heart. Well, they were still alive. Yes, it killed them, but if you die in a body, where your heart dies is where you will reincarnate. I cannot prove that's true. It's just a story I heard and, people talking to me stuff. So that's where that weird sacrifice thing came from it. But Cocopelli got sick and was dying. And so one of the two that was still with him said, we'll get you home. And he said, home is here. Do not take my heart. And the Native American woman, the old woman, who was younger, but I mean, he was there with them for a long time. She said to him, when you see your heart in stone, you will know it's the end times. So, flash forward. Here I am, and another person who was staying with me brought me a quartz It comes from a geode. A geode is like a rock with quartz in it, and then they cut it and stuff, and you have all this very plain rock on the outside, and inside are all these crystals. And sometimes you have one that's almost completely solid, except for an internal area of crystal growth. And so he brings me this, and it's big. I mean, it's like 6 inches tall and 5 inches wide. It's they've taken a blue dye and they've dyed it blue. And he it's a beautiful, unbelievably beautiful piece, but he puts it down in front of me and he said, "I got this for you." And I'm looking at this thing and I realized that the crystal center of it was in the exact shape of a human heart in stone. All of a sudden, that's when I remembered that exchange with the old lady. That's what made me, I flashed back into time and her saying that to me, him, Cole Capelli at the time, me now. And what did she say? She said it would be the end times. Mark the end times. Over the years, the blue dye has gone all into the area of the heart. And the clear crystal is all around it now. Anyway, it's a symbol. And one of the things you do find out in this line of work is there's a lot of symbols that go on. Okay, so we're coming to the end of this kind of like phase of my life because 9/11 happened. In the reality of the 1990s, no one would have. It couldn't have happened. It just couldn't have. But in 2000, I was home and I was home by myself. No family, Christmas, no family, no friends. Everybody had something else to do. And I, for the first time in my life, I'm home alone. But I'm in the Wilder Yard. So I'm, minding my own business. And I suddenly get this image in my head. And it's an image of a sphere with the talons of like an eagle on top of it, like a crown on top of it. It's made of wood. It's about 4 inches in diameter. When I was working on the house to put in a different electrical system, I had a worker with me, and he was in the bedroom and he was essentially opening up the wall so we could get behind it and replace the wiring. And all of a sudden, he comes into the kitchen. I was doing some dishes, or as I know I was at the sink, and he walks in. He's got something in his hand and it scared me. I'm going like, "What do you got in your hand?" And he said, "I just found this between the rafter, not the rafter, the horizontal wood there. I know what it is. It might come to me. The stud. And the wall, the outside wall. It was like jammed in between those two, like somebody had put it there." So I reach out and he puts it in my hand, and it's like I say, it's this sphere with these talons on it. And all I know is that this is something that is very powerful, and I don't want to deal with it. So I thanked him and I took it into the basically crystal room and had an awful lot of crystals in it. And I put it in an area where I felt that the energy would be contained within this crystal kind of like container that I had. And I forgot about it. So probably 10 years later, at least, on this Christmas where I'm by myself, this image comes into my head. I hadn't even thought about it. And I said to my guides, because I'm going like, okay, you're putting this picture in my head. What's this about? What do you want me to do? We want you to burn it. All right. So I had a little, portable fireplace, a clay natural fireplace, and put wood in it and you'd start a fire. So I go and I build this little fire thing. And then I go back and I get this piece of wood and I threw it in the fire. I don't know that I had any feeling whatsoever as to what this was all about. I just did what I was told and then sat back and watched it burn. And then I get the voices. We need you to jump timelines. And I'm like, what? We need you to jump timelines. I didn't question what it meant. I sort of had a knowing about it. Strange thing, because I didn't have it in my head, but I had a knowing though, this is your mission. And I hesitated. I really did hesitate. And I went, okay, will I win? And they said, yes. And then I said, will I save everybody? And they hesitated. And then they were like, yes. And then, the voices stopped because I said, all right, I'll do what I gotta do, jump timelines, let's go. And I didn't notice particularly a great change at that moment. And to be honest, I didn't feel that I was on a different timeline until 9 months later when the towers were destroyed on 9/11. So when we get into the next chapter, number nine, we'll talk about being on another timeline. Hope you're enjoying it. Be safe. I'll see you next time.
Say what? Say what radio show with no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.